Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you programs from radio's golden years. Mark Levone, your host for this hour of true history. Later on, from broadcasts of our freedom's blessings and the passing parade. But first, it's an episode of Democracy in America, a short-lived NBC series, this episode called The Chief Instrument of Freedom, from March 28, 1962.
The National Broadcasting Company, in conjunction with the Fund for Adult Education, presents Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville.
In America, the press constitutes a singular power, so strangely composed of mingled good and evil that liberty could not live without it, and public order can hardly be maintained against it. It causes political life to circulate through all parts of the vast territory. Its eye is constantly open to detect the secret springs of political designs and to summon the leaders of all parties in turn to the bar of public opinion. It rallies the interests of the community around certain principles and draws up the creed of every party. In the United States, each separate newspaper exercises but little authority. But the power of the press is second only to that of the people.
The Chief Instrument of Freedom. A study in the American press. Item 11 in the series Democracy in America. Prepared by the Division of General Education of New York University. Under the direction of George Probst, American historian. A series designed to bring to life the America of the 1830s, as recorded by Alexis de Tocqueville, and so to illuminate the image of democracy itself. A study in the American press, the chief instrument of freedom.
When Beaumont and I left America in 1832, the American press was on the verge of a great transition. While we were in America, daily newspapers cost 6 cents as a rule. This was too much for the working man. This sixpenny press, as it was called, was edited in the main by and for business institutions and politicians. No one of the 55 newspapers in New York had more than a circulation of 2,000 copies.
Then, suddenly, a year after we left, the great change took place. The penny press was started by the New York Sun in 1833. And what interested the 6 cent public did not interest the penny public. Soon there was a newspaper in the hands of every man in the city and even of every boy old enough to read. These papers are to be found in every hotel, tavern, counting house, shop, etc. Almost every porter and drayman, while not engaged in his occupation, may be seen with a paper in his hands.
Even after we left America, we were able to follow the American press and to discover the inflated and bombastic claims of the self-confident editors of the penny press. Editors who collected all their own news and wrote the entire paper themselves, such as the celebrated Scottish-born James Gordon Bennett.
May 6, 1835. My first declaration of policy for the New York Herald, price one penny. In debuts of this kind, many talk of principle, political principle, party principle, as a sort of steel trap to catch the public. We openly disdain all steel traps. All principle, as it is called, all party, all politics. Our only guide shall be good, sound, practical common sense, applicable to the business and bosoms of men engaged in everyday life. We shall endeavor to record facts on every public and proper subject, stripped of verbiage and coloring, with comments, when suitable, just, independent, fearless, and good-tempered. The editors of many of the other daily newspapers are heavy speculators in Wall Street and are truly unfit by nature to come to a right conclusion upon any subject. They pervert every public event from its proper hue and coloring to raise one stalk and depress another. There is no truth in them.
Every profession, of course, has its class spirit. The characteristics of the American journalist often consist in an open and coarse appeal to the passions of his readers. He abandons principles to assail the characters of individuals, to track them into private life and disclose all their weaknesses and vices. The first American newspaper over which we cast our eyes contained the following article on the President of the United States, Andrew Jackson.
In all this affair, the language of Jackson, the President, has been that of a heartless despot, solely occupied with the preservation of his own authority. Intrigue is his native element. He governs by means of corruption, and his immoral practices will redound to his shame and confusion. His conduct in the political arena has been that of a shameless and lawless gamester.
And this sort of attack is perfectly usual. Any American journalist would tell you the same, will indeed boast of it.
Why shouldn't I boast of it? In America, the press is a mighty power. I share a little of that power.
What, sir, do you do exactly?
I'm a correspondent of one of the New York papers.
Oh, you write the letters from Washington for that paper?
Precisely so. And it's a more difficult task to write a good letter than to make a bad speech.
Well, no doubt of that, sir. You may often be employed in making the best of a bad argument.
What do you mean, sir?
I mean by improving what has been said by a senator or representative.
Not only that, but it is we that give the cue to every argument. The representatives in Congress take up a question as they find it stated in the papers.
And it is you that govern the country.
It's the press, sir, and nothing but the press which governs free people.
But is not the press liable to error?
All human institutions are. But we have such abundant means of correcting and preventing it that it's almost impossible for us to be in the wrong. In the first place, our press has the money by which it can secure the best talents, such as me. And secondly, our people are too cool to be easily wrought into a passion. We are a calculating people.
But your papers are full of personal abuse. Do you think that an advantage?
Not exactly, but it's unquestionably a great help, a seasoning of dull editorials. Our people have so much ordinary conversation in the course of the day that if it were not for the slander contained in our newspapers, they would not be amused at all.
Papers, sir, are the eating, drink, and fuel of the Americans. And on that account, they can never be too hot for them.
But very high seasoning marks a bad taste. I should think the best papers on what is called the aristocratic side would scorn personal abuse.
Quite the reverse, sir, I assure you. It's the only means of attracting notoriety and of pleasing our first people. Besides, it'd be useless to play the part of a gentleman in that respect when all the rest are blackguards. We want strength, sir, strength and nothing but strength. None of your milk and molasses productions of which a man can make neither head nor tail. If we give a man a beating, we do not want him to get up again. We go the whole hog. When we attack a man, we assail at once his moral, political, religious, and domestic relations. Every little helps, you know. Give a dog a bad name and hang him, says the proverb, and it is just so with our politicians.
Indeed, it is pitiful to see what coarse insults, what small vilifications, and what imprudent calumnies fill the journals which serve as party organs.
I have always felt that whatever the divine providence permitted to occur, I was not too proud to report.
To say nothing of the fact that an American newspaper cheerfully prints whatever eccentric notion has entered the editor's head.
The motto of the New York Hawk and Buzzard: our gossip bird shall keep a bright lookout and show the world what folly is about
him. I cannot support John Quincy Adams because he has introduced the billiard table into the president's house for the amusement of its inmates and visitors, thus holding out inducements to engage in a captivating vice, departing from plain Republican manners, imitating the court etiquette of regal power, and furnishing an example to the youth of our country which I conceive can be neither too generally nor too severely reprehended.
I found at the Indianapolis Gazette, 60 miles from the nearest post office, in a buckeye log cabin of one room, part of which was occupied for family residence, and the ink was put on with balls of dressed deerskin stuffed with wool.
An editor might have started as a lawyer, a preacher, or a self-educated printer. But as an editor, he's let himself in for an exciting life. If he doesn't speak his mind, people lose respect for him. If he speaks his mind too much, he's in danger of life and limb. Editors openly accuse one another of the most disgusting acts, and the pistol is an editorial accessory not infrequently used. I reckon that's why the hard-pressed newspaper man wears his hat at his desk, so as to be able to make a hurried exit.
The policy of James Gordon Bennett. I want to make the New York Herald the great organ of social life, the prime element of civilization, the channel through which native talent, native genius, and native power may bubble up daily. I shall mix together commerce and business, pure religion and morals, literature and poetry, the drama and dramatic purity, till the Herald shall outstrip everything in the conception of man. The age of trashy novels, of more trashy poems, of more trashy quarterly and weekly literature is rapidly drawing to a close. This is the age of the daily press.
We live by our advertisements. Our advertising columns are open to the public, the whole public, and nothing but the public. We admit any advertisements of anything or any opinion from any persons who will pay the price.
The way these American editors speak of the financing of their newspapers reminds us that in America, writers are brain merchants. Literature is an industry. There is neither a classical school nor a romantic school. There is only the commercial school.
Oh, calme, Beaumont.
Well, you know very well, Tocqueville, these writers will edit newspapers, pamphlets, advertisements. They sell ideas as others sell cloth. Their desk is a counter. Their artistic souls are yard goods. Each article has its price, and they will tell you exactly what a printed inspiration costs.
True, up to a point. But some of the editors of the penny press saw their newspapers as superseding all other institutions.
What is to prevent a daily newspaper from being made the greatest organ of social life? Books have had their day. The theaters have had their day. The temple of religion has had its day. A newspaper can be made to take the lead of all these in the great movements of human thought and of human civilization. A newspaper can send more souls to heaven and save more from hell than all the churches or chapels in New York, besides making money at the same time. Let it be tried.
This is a most extravagant view of the function of the press. But even in 1831, before the revolution of the penny newspapers, the American press was the general and universal literature of the country. In the whole of America, there were more than 1,200 newspapers.
Twice as many as in France and England put together.
In New York City, there were 55 newspapers, many of them weekly, but 11 of them were daily.
A very remarkable thing for a city of little over 200,000 inhabitants.
But in 1831, no one of these papers dominated the others. Not one sold as many as 2,000 copies.
The ease with which American newspapers can be established produces a multitude of them. Each county has a newspaper. But as competition prevents any considerable profit, persons of much capacity are rarely led to engage in these undertakings. Such is the number of the public prints that even if they were a source of wealth, writers of ability could not be found to direct them all. The journalists of the United States are generally in a very humble position, with a scanty education and a vulgar turn of mind. Not authors, really, but idea mongers.
The editor of the New York Courier and Enquirer, James Watson Webb, was foolish enough yesterday to assault your editor in the street. In the course of the scuffle, he gave me a smart rap over the head. The fellow, no doubt, wanted to let out the never-failing supply of good humor and wit which has created such a reputation for the New York Herald and appropriate the contents to supply the emptiness of his own thick skull. He did not succeed, however, in rifling my ideas. My ideas in a few days will flow as fresh as ever, and he will find it so to his cost. My damage is a scratch about 3/4 of an inch in length on the third finger of the left hand, which I received from the iron railing I was forced against, and 3 buttons from my vest, which any tailor will reinstate for a 6 months. His loss is a rent from top to bottom of a very beautiful black coat, which cost the ruffian $40, and a blow in the face, which may have knocked down his throat some of his infernal teeth for anything I know. Balance in my favor, $39.94, and the admiration of my vast public.
This editor's report increased his circulation by 9,000 and was therefore satisfactory. The will of the majority is the most general of laws, and it establishes certain habits to which everyone must conform.
An editor must always be with the people, think with them, feel with them. And he need fear nothing. He will always be right, always be strong, always popular, always free. The world has been humbugged long enough by spouters and talkers and conventioners and legislators et genus omne. This is the editorial age and the most intellectual of all past ages.
Well, the claim of the press to be the prime element of civilization has some point to it. In ages of equality, every man naturally stands alone. He is easily got rid of, and he is trampled on with impunity. At the present time, an oppressed member of the community has therefore only one method of self-defense. He may appeal to the whole nation, and if the whole nation is deaf to his complaint, he may appeal to mankind. The only means he has of making this appeal is by the press. Thus, the liberty of the press is infinitely more valuable among democratic nations than among all others. It is the only cure for the evils that equality may produce. Equality sets men apart and weakens them. But the press places a wonderful weapon within every man's reach, which the weakest and loneliest of them all may use. Equality deprives a man of the support of his connections, but the press enables him to summon all his fellow men to his assistance.
Yes, and every printer feels his responsibility. Do you remember the 4th of July celebrations in Albany? Part of the procession included wagons and floats, and one of the most interesting and one of the most significant was the printer float.
Well, this like is the wagon of the Association of Printers and Albany Typographical Society. At the front end, we got a gilt bust of Benjamin Franklin, one of the fathers of independence.
And he spent a lot of time in France. We know something of the famous Mr. Franklin.
Ah.
But while recognizing that Franklin was a great man, why do you choose to carry his bust on the printer's wagon?
Because he was a printer himself, that's why. In this country, men can rise to greatness and still be proud of their old trades. Old Ben became a great man, but he was still a printer, trained. He got his education not in cloistered halls, but in front of a typecase.
Very extraordinary. And Benjamin Franklin was also a very witty author.
Well, that's what I'm telling you, gentlemen. I can see you don't quite understand the situation of a printer in America.
Evidently not.
Well, I'm a printer. I set type. I do odd printing jobs. But I bring out a newspaper. I collect the news. I write it up and I print it. I have my views about how things should be run, and they're pretty decided views. I write them down, and I print them.
So a printer is also an editor and a journalist.
That's what he is. Here. Here's a copy of my own paper. Read over the editorials at your leisure. You'll find some of them pretty stinging, I reckon.
I'm sure we shall.
Oh, these announcements of weddings.
Oh, that's a regular thing. Don't you have them?
Certainly, but what is this motto that you have placed at the head of the column?
Yeah, it's a pretty good motto, eh?
The trap sprung, another fool caught.
My views on matrimony. I'm a confirmed bachelor.
As you please, but don't your readers object?
That's their right. An American editor is used to objections from the public. Favorite American pastime, trying to horsewhip the editor. And, of course, in some parts of the country, a lot of editors have to fight duels. Haven't fought any myself, but I have had something to do with readers objecting.
But this doesn't seem to worry you.
Why should it? If a man objects real hard, he can go and start his own paper.
In theory, yes, but can he really?
Of course he can. What do you suppose I did? It only costs a few $100s, and you're in business. The power of the press, gentlemen, is accessible to everyone. Now, let's have a look at this float of ours. The object in the middle is, of course, a printing press. It's a climber press, if you're interested in such things. And the bird flying over is
the American Eagle.
Yeah, good for you.
Who is he carrying in his claws? It looks like a bust.
It is a bust.
Of Benjamin Franklin again?
Yeah, good for you a second time. Now, you gentlemen being French, I shan't have to tell you what the scroll says in the bird's mouth.
Vérité sans peur.
Truth without fear.
Yeah. A noble sentiment. Very appropriate.
But who are the figures that support all this splendor?
On the right, the goddess of liberty supporting the American flag.
Again, very appropriate.
Yeah. And on the left, the figure of a slave bound in chains. You'll observe the slave has burst the shackles on one arm and is reaching like toward the press for emancipation. That's where it'll come from, you know. And behind, there's a crown reversed and a broken scepter. All pretty much to the point when you know where it's supposed to be heading. All highly illustrative of the strength and universality of the power of the press.
The freedom of the press in America began with Jefferson, who was himself roasted on what he called the gridiron of the press. In countries where the doctrine of the sovereignty of the people ostensibly prevails, the censorship of the press is not only dangerous, but absurd.
Is it possible that the publication of facts, or even rumors, can have any tendency to defeat the general operation of justice? If this were true, the more utterly ignorant a man is, the fitter he is to sit as a juror. The honesty, the purity, the integrity of legal practice and decisions throughout the country are more indebted to the American press than to the whole tribe of lawyers and judges who issue their decrees. The press is the living jury of the nation.
When the right of every citizen to a share in the government of society is acknowledged, everyone must be presumed to be able to choose between the various opinions of his contemporaries and to appreciate the different facts from which inferences may be drawn. The censorship of the press and universal suffrage are two things which are irreconcilably opposed and which cannot long be retained among the institutions of the same people. Not a single individual of the millions who inhabit the United States has as yet dared to propose any restrictions on the liberty of the press.
Much of this became clear as we watched the press, both during our stay in America and later as the penny press began. Tocqueville and I were also instructed by Mr. J.G. Spencer, a most distinguished lawyer whom we met at Canandaigua in the state of New York. We asked Mr. Spencer what the influence of the press might be on public opinion.
Here in America, we enjoy all the benefits and advantages of a vicious free press. Let me answer you, Mr. Beaumont, by telling you about an editor I know who always says he makes a moral distinction between telling lies in conversation and telling lies in a newspaper, where everybody expects them.
Then we must not believe what we read in a newspaper?
In a newspaper, no. You may be deceived. In the press as a whole, things may be different. Every point of view is represented so strongly that in the midst of the lies and abuse, you can often make out the drift of the truth. Enlightenment through deceit, you could call it.
Under these circumstances, Mr. Spencer, does the press have any influence?
It has a great influence. But it does not exercise it in the same manner as in France. Thus, we attach very little value to the opinions of the journalist. He obtains influence only through the facts which he makes known and the turn he gives them. It's in this way that he sometimes succeeds in misleading opinion about a man or a measure.
What are the limits that you put on the liberty of the press?
Our principle in this matter is very simple. Everything in the realm of opinion is perfectly free. In America, one could every day print that a monarchy is the best of all governments. But when a journal publishes calumnies, when it gratuitously attributes culpable intentions, then it is sued and ordinarily punished with a heavy fine.
What is, in your opinion, the way to diminish the influence of the periodical press?
I am completely convinced that the most effective of all is to multiply the number of newspapers as far as possible and sue them only in extreme cases. Their power diminishes as they become more numerous. With us, interests are divided in a thousand ways. There are no great centers of action.
As we have in Paris.
With us, it is almost impossible to agitate public opinion over a large area. The New York City newspapers have no more influence on us than those of the neighboring village. Another reason for the small influence obtained by journalists through the expression of their personal opinions is the ill use they put them to in the first years of the Republic. At that time, it was proved that most of them were in the pay of England. From that time on, public confidence was taken away from them.
In some ways, then, the power of the press is greater in France than in America, and more dangerous for us.
After all, in America, the press is by no means all-powerful. Both Jefferson and Jackson, who is president at this very moment, were elected against the concerted advice of the press.
And yet the press in America remains so free. Is there ever a prosecution launched against it by the government?
By the government? Not since Jefferson. He instituted the freedom of the press. And it's reasonable, gentlemen. After all, it's logical.
How so?
Well,
We Americans, having once admitted the doctrine of the sovereignty of the people, apply it with perfect sincerity. It was never our intention, out of elements which are changing every day, to create institutions that should last forever. And there is consequently nothing criminal in an attack upon existing laws, provided a violent infraction of them is not intended. We also believe courts of justice are powerless to restrain the abuses of the press without the loss of liberty, and that, as the flexibility of human language perpetually escapes judicial definition, offenses of this nature evade in some manner or other the long arm of the law.
Newspapers, therefore, become more necessary in proportion as men become more equal. To suppose that they only serve to protect freedom would be to diminish their importance. They maintain civilization. In democratic countries, newspapers frequently lead the citizens to launch together into very ill-digested schemes. But if there were no newspapers, there would be no common activity. The evil which they produce is therefore much less than that which they cure. I think that men living in aristocracies may, strictly speaking, do without the liberty of the press, but such is not the case with those who live in democratic countries. To protect every man's personal independence, I do not trust to great political assemblies, to parliamentary privilege, or to the assertion of popular sovereignty. All these things may, to a certain extent, be reconciled with personal servitude. But that servitude cannot be complete if the press is free. The press is the chief democratic instrument of freedom.
You have just heard The Chief Instrument of Freedom, a study in the American Press, item 11 in a series based on Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. This series, presented by the National Broadcasting Company, was prepared by the Division of General Education of New York University under the direction of George Probst, American historian.
Democracy in America, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 28th of March, 1962 on NBC, broadcast in conjunction with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It ran from January of 1962 through April of that year, producing 14 broadcasts. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up next, our Freedom's Blessings, with a story about photography called Look at the Birdie, from June 21st, 1952.
Uncle York's a fine old feller, gonna be our storyteller. Been around for a century, keeping an eye on you and me. A poking here and a poking there, he's got a pine tree for his hair. Ticker tape for an artery, Indian sitting on his knee.
I'm your storyteller, Uncle York. I've been around a long time. My eyes have seen everything that's ever happened in New York State. I'm craggy, and I'm old. I watched the Dutch moor their ships in Manhattan. I helped the vineyard planters of the Lake Counties. I helped cut the white pine of the Adirondacks. The story I'm going to tell you today has been produced and transcribed by the New York State Department of Commerce, and dedicated to all the men and women everywhere through whose courage and enterprise we enjoy our freedom's blessings. I want to tell you about a story that begun at a breakfast table in Rochester. Yeah, it was in the 1870s, about the time of Kit Custer. But the fellow sitting at the table was a thin young bank clerk. So thin, his mother was kind of worried about him.
George Eastman, you're getting thin as pie crust. I'm going to make you another batch of wheat cakes, and I want you to eat them, every single one.
Sorry, Mother, I won't have time.
You ought to take a vacation, son. Or better yet, take up a hobby. What have whatever happened about that photography you used to be interested in?
Oh, where in Tophet's my hat?
Right here, dear, right here.
Oh. Say, if I did take a vacation, maybe I'd take my camera along.
Oh, George, with all that equipment, well, you couldn't carry anything else. Mm. Oh, you forgot your scarf.
Oh, thanks. Gosh, wouldn't it be wonderful to take a trip to some tropical place and take a camera along? Just think, you'd have a diary and pictures.
Oh, but George, last time you went out to take pictures, well, you were all tuckered out just from carrying your equipment. You spent all day and only got one good photograph.
Oh, I'd need some lessons before going on a real trip, Mother.
Lessons in photography?
Yes. Why not? There must be a professional photographer here in Rochester. Tell you what, when I get home tonight, I'm going to look him up and see what he'll charge me to teach me what he knows.
Hello. Oh, was that you, Mr. Strong?
Yes, Mrs. Eastman. Say, what on earth is George doing in front of the house? Is he camping out there for his vacation?
Well, what do you mean?
The tent. George and that fellow have a little tent set up.
Oh, that's a dark tent. George is taking photography lessons.
Oh, for heaven's sake. What's the tent for?
Isn't that terrible? They have to coat the plates in the dark with the wet emulsion, you know, just before they take a picture. He's practicing taking photographs of the house.
Oh, I didn't know it was so complicated.
Oh, yes. He has to load the camera in a dark place, and then he has to take a photograph right away while the plate's wet. And besides that, he has to keep all the chemicals handy for developing.
Well, I'll have to go out and bait George a little on his new hobby. What is it they call those photography fellas? A knight of the black art?
Yeah? George was a camera bug already. Just an amateur, but he got so interested, sweating away in the little dark tent with his collodion and his silver nitrate and all the paraphernalia. First thing he knew, he was spending every spare minute away from the bank taking pictures. The boarder in the Eastman household, Mr. Henry Strong, kept a sharp eye on the young fellow. One night late, he found George in the kitchen.
Why, George Eastman, I thought I heard burglars down here. What are you doing down here so late?
I might ask you the same thing, Henry.
Well, I was just going to burgle a piece of your mother's cherry pie.
Sit down, Henry. I've stumbled onto something good.
Now, listen, you shouldn't be keeping these late hours, George. You look dead.
I've found a way to simplify photography.
You look as though you've been swimming in that nitrate.
Oh, that's nothing. Now, listen, will you? I read an article in the London Photography Journal with a formula for a dry plate.
Oh, you mean it eliminates that messy, wet emulsion?
Yes. And I've tried this dry plate formula over and over, and I think I've improved on it.
You mean no more dark tent and bottles of chemicals? You mean a photographer can leave his pack mule at home?
Well, that's it, Henry. And tomorrow, the minute I get home from the bank, I'm going to try it out. So just pray for sunshine.
The eternal hope of the camera fiend, a sunny day. Yeah, that was the year 1879. Well, all that Saturday, George took pictures. Everything went wrong. He got cloudy the wrong moment, and his hasty dropped his bottle of formula and had to start all over. But finally, back in the kitchen of the little Eastman house.
Oh, poor George. I hope this comes out, Mr. Strong. He's thanking so much on it, and it'll save him all that fuss and bother.
Not only George, it'll save trouble for a lot of people.
Here's your photograph of the house, Mother. Don't touch it yet. It's not quite dry.
Oh, George, it's wonderful. Why, you can even see where the house needs paint.
What do you think, Henry?
Well, I'd say it's the best photograph you've made.
You see, in spite of all the things that went wrong in advance, once I got the dry plate made, taking the photograph and developing it were comparatively simple.
Yes, in just about half the usual time. I think you've got something, George.
I'd like to know what other photographers might think of it. Professionals, I mean. I'm going to make up some dry plates and send them around the country.
Oh, now, don't forget, George, this started out to be just a hobby. You mustn't neglect the bank, you know.
Oh, banking and insurance are all right, Mother, but I've been doing that since I was 14. Now, for the first time in my life, I'm really having fun.
George, being a cautious fella, kept his job at the bank. In a short time, though, he opened a little dry plate company in a room over a music store. He worked there every night and every weekend. Then one Saturday night, his mother was sitting in the parlor with Henry Strong, waiting for George to come home.
Hello, Mother. Oh, hello, Henry. Say, I've got some good news.
George, Mr. Strong and I intend
to... Now, wait a minute. Don't you want to hear my good news?
All right, son. I guess nobody can stop you. Well, what is it?
My machine. I've got it working. It coats the plates mechanically.
What's this? What machine?
Well, I didn't want to say anything in case it didn't turn out. But I've worked out a way to coat dry plates mechanically. My machine does it better and quicker than you can do it by hand. And it's cheap. Mass production, that's the thing.
Well, this sounds very impressive, George. When can we see it?
Oh, Henry, I'm so worked up now I couldn't go to bed. Come on down to the shop with me now. I'll show you how...
George Eastman, don't you dare leave this house. I've got a sandwich for you in the kitchen, and you're going straight to bed.
You mean you're going to put plates on market on big scale, George, or do you want to sell these machines?
I'm going to patent the machine and sell dry plates to jobbers all over the country. Europe, too.
You're going to need capital. If you're going on it in a big scale like that...
Well, I've got $3,000 saved. That'll do for a start. But I'll need some investors, too. How'd you like to be a partner, Henry?
That was the simple start of the Eastman Dry Plate Company, Strong and Eastman proprietors. Now, George quit his job at the bank, and his hobby carried him straight into a new and challenging industry. Well, hardly an industry yet. But George's new dry plate was destined to help it grow big. He had 6 people working for him that winter, turning out the plates, which went to his jobbers on a contract basis, so many each month. Winter was a slack season, of course, and the new little company waited for spring, like the photographer waits for a sunny day. But instead of spring sunshine, there was literally a spring flood of letters pouring into the little office of George Eastman.
Joe, those plates we bought last winter are just no good.
Yeah, I know. Emulsion is dead, Bill.
Dry plates are just plain useless.
The emulsion, of course. The jobbers didn't keep track of the stock. They used the new stuff first and left the old plates in stock. We'll have to make it good, that's all.
Make it good? Well, where's the money coming from, George? You and I both have put in $5,000 already.
If we're going to build a business, Henry, we've got to build it on a good, solid foundation. Now, we had a wonderful start. This was just a stroke of bad luck, the emulsion not keeping over the winter.
But you'll have to work out another formula.
Sure, Henry, but we can do it. We'll close the factory for a while and find out what's wrong. Then we'll start again and send good new plates to everyone who's had bad ones.
So they called back all the plates they had made that winter. And George went back to work with his gelatin and nitrate and collodion. Then came the real blow. His emulsion wouldn't work. Try as he would, George Eastman couldn't duplicate the first batch. It looked like the end of the little company.
469. If it doesn't work this time, I give up.
469 experiments. All recorded in his tattered notebooks. Then he got one that looked promising. But the bottle broke, and he lost the whole thing. George Eastman was absolutely unable to duplicate his first emulsion formula. Eventually, after months of work, he found his formula trouble stemmed from a batch of poor gelatin. But his company's name was so good after taking back the bad plates, he had no trouble starting up again. As soon as he'd gotten a new emulsion, he started making dry plates again.
Henry, if we could get rid of this glass plate, we could make photography simple enough for a child.
Oh, good heavens, George. After all the trouble you went to get an emulsion?
We'll use our emulsion, only not on glass. If there were some way to apply it to paper, a roll of paper coated with a thin film of emulsion, you could load the camera with that instead of with the plate.
He kept mulling that idea around, till finally with a fellow named Walker, Eastman designed an attachment to hold a roll of paper film. They called it a roll holder, and it did away entirely with the need of having a plate in your camera. And then...
Henry, if we could make a camera that's self-contained, a compact unit that anybody could take pictures with, Maybe we could sell it already loaded. And people could send the whole camera back to the factory to have the film developed.
That's how the Kodak was born. Soon to become a household word. Why, Gilbert and Sullivan even put Eastman's slogan into an operetta. You press the button, we do the rest. And the price of the simplified camera, starting at $25, slowly went down to a small fraction of that. Eastman had accomplished his purpose.
Uncle York's a fine old feller. He has been our storyteller.
Yeah, hard to believe, knowing the story of that amateurish beginning, that right here in New York State, there's over 160 companies making photographic equipment. Yeah, as long as New York's industries don't stand still, they'll keep on adding to our freedom's lessons.
Our Freedom's Blessings, on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated recording from the 21st of June, 1952. And we now wrap up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday with the talented storyteller John Nesbitt bringing us the tale of Wild Jack Howard on the program The Passing Parade, the syndicated broadcast from 1949.
This is John Nesbitt with another chapter in the review of human adventure, which we call Our Passing Parade. And this time we deal with the highly melodramatic account of a man who appears to have courted death for all the days of his life. Watching our review now, down in Australia, every sailor and cowpuncher and lumberman still clearly remembers Wild Jack Howard, the toughest fighter, the best sport, the best drinker, and the man who could cuss the longest on a single breath of any man in Queensland. They remember also that he was a big man with heavy black eyebrows and a great booming laugh. He was the kind of a man that you could always depend upon to lend you all the money that he had in his pocket if you were broke or needed a drink. They also remember that he showed up in Sydney about 22 years ago as a common deckhand on a sailing ship and promptly spent all his wages buying drinks for everybody in sight. Then he went to work as a cowhand, next as a sawmill hand, and suddenly acquiring some money, no one could imagine where or how, he bought himself a sheep ranch. Australians next remember that Wild Jack, one of the best-loved men in the bush country, suddenly disappeared. A few months later, when the English newspapers arrived, they saw his picture on page one. Under the picture was his name, but it was not printed Wild Jack Howard, but His Lordship Charles Henry George Howard, Earl of Suffolk. That was just the first time that the amazing Earl of Suffolk astounded and delighted the world. For 20 generations, the Earls of Suffolk have done just about as they pleased, and what they pleased to do was invariably dangerous. They have been explorers, privateers, rebels, and patriots. In fact, the father of the first Earl of Suffolk was gently beheaded by Queen Elizabeth because he was a little bit too unruly. And it was in the first week of March, 1906, that the 20th Earl, Charles Henry George Howard, arrived on Earth as the heir to a 40-room Renaissance-style mansion and a 10,000-acre estate called Charlton Park. By the time he was 17 years old, Charles Henry George Howard was bored to death. The Earls of Suffolk had always gone to sea, so the new Earl was sent to the Royal Naval College. He lasted just 1 year. Then he went down to a second-hand store at the waterfront, bought himself the oldest clothes he could find, and calling himself Jack Howard, he got a berth as a common sailor and went to sea the way he wanted to. He returned the following year, believe it or not, with a pet parrot on his shoulder, a beard on his face, and a green snake and a skull and crossbones tattooed on his forearm. His mother, the Dowager Countess of Suffolk, a former American girl from Chicago, by the way, broke down and wept when she saw him. Charles Henry George agreed to shave off the beard and to join the Scots Guard. That lasted just 11 months. Then he was off for Australia again as Jack Howard. When he returned 6 years later to manage the enormous estate in England, he almost went mad looking for things to do that would be exciting. He tried going to college. He went to Oxford, where he studied high explosives and poisons, but he was still bored. Actually, when the Second World War began in 1939, it was a godsend to this wretchedly unhappy man who had searched everywhere on earth to escape the boredom of great wealth. He was one of those amazing human beings who are born for excitement and danger, whose physical makeup actually has to have the stimulus of excitement to function properly. And so promptly, the Monday morning after the Athenia was torpedoed, he rushed down to the office of the Minister of War in England, demanded to be signed up at once. 2 hours later, he walked out of the office. He strode down the street. He turned into a bar. Ordering 12 double brandies to be set on the table in front of him, he drank them all down, hurling the empty glasses across the room. For while Jack Howard, the Earl of Suffolk, had been rejected from military service because of an old infection of rheumatic fever that he had picked up in the tropics. But he went to France anyway as a civilian to be as close to the fighting as possible. In Paris, wearing a 10-gallon hat that he had bought in Australia and a pair of automatic pistols stuck under his belt, during the period of the phony war, he entertained crowds in bar rooms by sitting at a table and shooting plates out of midair. Then, in the midst of this foolishness, he discovered a job that a civilian could do. He knew that the Germans would probably take Paris. He also knew that in the bank vaults there were enormous supplies of industrial diamonds that had been brought in from Belgium to keep them from falling into the hands of the Germans. Diamonds have a far greater value in wartime than in peace, for they are used as cutting tools in working the hardest steels in the making of guns. With a big French sailor pal to help him, he went to the largest bank in Paris, presented his card, and announced that he was there to take all the diamonds in the bank and carry them over to England, where they would be useful in winning the war. Of course, the banker simply looked at him in amazement and refused. And the next thing the banker noticed about this extraordinary man was that he was holding an automatic pistol in each hand. At least, that is what the banker explained to his board of directors. 2 days later, the Earl of Suffolk, his French bodyguard, and a pretty 21-year-old blonde secretary started out at 70 miles an hour from Paris for Bordeaux in the south of France. In the back of their car was a satchel which contained an estimated $2 million worth of industrial diamonds. Arriving once more in England and presenting the diamonds to his government with his compliments, Charles Henry George Howard again found life utterly, unendurably boring. He started looking around for something new and dangerous to do, and he found it. In the year 1940, the Blitzkrieg of London began. Large areas in the city had to be roped off and guarded by police, and signs warned that an unexploded bomb was in the vicinity. At any unknown instant, that bomb would go off. To go near one of them was to ask for death. The Earl, of course, was delighted, for he had found a wonderful new occupation, dismantling unexploded bombs. Now, he had a certain careful technique of handling these bombs. He would arrive in his 16-cylinder limousine with that pretty secretary at his side, and he would park 2 blocks away. Then he would get out of the car and hand his ivory cigarette holder to the girl. Take good care of that. It's valuable. If anything happens, I don't want it ruined. Then he would take a field telephone with a long wire attached to it, which was connected with another instrument in the car. Walking up to the bomb, he would carefully dictate to his secretary as he worked, telling her correctly everything that he did. This was so that if the bomb exploded and the Earl were killed, the next man who took his place would know what he had done wrong and not make the same mistake with another type of that bomb. English explosive experts learned more from the Earl's notes than if they'd been able to see inside a German munitions plant. The Earl got to know German bombs so well that he became bored with them. He got so that he could tell at a glance which ones were dangerous and which were harmless duds. He became so very bored with the whole thing that he carried the dud bombs up to his concrete laboratory and kept them there as souvenirs, writing insulting remarks about how stupid the Germans were across the sides of the bombs. On one of them, he chalked the label, Old Faithful. He was having a wonderful time now. He had enough excitement for even the 20th Earl of Suffolk. He would swagger down the streets of London wearing loud checkered trousers, yellow vests, and always that 10-gallon hat. He loved to irritate his family by wearing it. Every night was a party for the Earl and the staff that worked with him, and the treats were always on the Earl. Having turned his mansion into a convalescent home for soldiers, he threw these parties at waterfront hash houses, and he entertained his guests by playing the latest American swing tunes on the piano. Finally, he decided that his staff needed a vacation. At a dinner party in a London restaurant, Sunday night, May 10th, 1942, he made his announcement. The whole crowd would go up to his estate and do nothing but loaf for 2 weeks at his expense. While everyone was drinking to this wonderful vacation, his friends noticed that he called over the head waiter. As the man came up, the Earl held up his little finger. Do you see that finger, Felix? Now, you be good to that finger, because one of these days, that's all of me that will show up for dinner. Then he gave the head waiter a 5-pound note as a tip, and the party broke up. The next morning, Monday, he and his crew went to the concrete laboratory to clean up a few bits of work before leaving on their vacation. So the Earl reached up and took down the dud bomb, Old Faithful. He said, "Well, you foolish old thing, as a matter of precaution, I'd best take care of you before I go." He set it in the vise on the workbench, and picking up a wrench, adjusted it carefully and put it in place on the fuse mechanism of that bomb to take it apart. His hand pressed on the handle of the wrench. An instant later, the sirens began to scream, for the wardens thought there must be a bombing raid. They heard such a tremendous explosion. 8 members of that bomb squad, including the pretty blonde secretary and the Earl himself, were instantly killed. The 20th Earl of Suffolk, who had gleefully courted death all of his life, had found it at last. As a footnote for today's review concerning Howard, the 20th Earl of Suffolk, we have time to observe that his malady, a subconscious pleasure in flirting with death, is one of the commonest causes which leads great men to great adventure. We have many such stories in the Parade Files, and as this year's edition comes to you again and again, we will see that danger itself may be the driving force that has led many a man to change the world. But our time's up, so until we meet again, this is John Nesbitt bidding a goodbye to you all.
The Passing Parade, on Tuned to Yesterday, a 1949 syndicated episode, bringing us to a close for this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden era. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.